Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassame. So I arrived this evening as I'm sitting here wondering what to say this evening. And the first prompt I got was the dedication. This person who's having heart problems and under investigation for heart problems, been fainting. Because, of course, this is where I was 3 years ago. So it sparked something in me. I felt a welling of compassion for the person. Not an easy position to be in. They can't find out what's wrong with you. You could be in danger of your life. So it sparked something. But looking back on it, you know, the highlights of, on the positive side of perhaps of that whole experience is a deepening of the realization of anatta. So we went along from that dedication to be chanting the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. So it seemed very fitting. You sat there with a heart rate of 260, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Whatever you do, it just bangs away like that and comes and goes as it will. That kind of thing, then it can be very liberating, actually. That sense of not being able to do anything can be very liberating. It could be very frightening, or it could be very liberating. And thankfully, there were situations in which, for me, it was a very liberating experience. So that was something that I would like to be able to offer to this man, of course, isn't it? You know, I'd like to be able to say to him, look, this can be a really liberating experience. Yeah. But of course, it takes quite a lot to prepare the mind and to find a calm enough state of mind for that kind of effect to happen, for that sense of freedom or a sense of release or relief. To be the reaction rather than fear or panic. This is the fruits of the practice, isn't it? This is the kind of thing that we're preparing ourselves for in our practice, these kinds of events. When things get out of our control, that we can let go rather than trying to hang on. And this is these kind of extreme examples are things that really get the message home. And yet there's examples in our life occurring all the time, isn't there, of hanging on or letting go, trying to control something that's outside of our control, and trying to get beyond our limits. So this sutta is talking to us about our limits, isn't it? We're not masters of the world, we're not masters of ourselves or what we take to be ourselves either. Our thoughts, feelings, the body, they're all connected up with the body, all impermanent, all unsatisfactory, not something we can master. So this can be a depressing fact, can't it? Looking our limitations straight in the face, or it can be a liberating one. If it hits us right, we can develop a sense of humour even over our limitations. If we have a good attitude, we hit the wall and start laughing instead of crying over it. No, I can't do this anymore. Oh, yes. It's a limitation. Big surprise, isn't it? The system has its limitations. This body, this system, this existence has its limitations. And we bump up against them. We keep bumping up against the Dhamma. We can either see this as a negative thing or a liberating thing. So very often this kind of contemplation is practice, isn't it? If after meditation, you know, when the mind's very peaceful, then you turn the mind towards this kind of perception, not being able to control, letting go, seeing things as part of nature, in whatever way works for you, in order to let go. And then that will deepen the meditation. So actually the primary reason for contemplating like this is not to come to terms with the world or to see what our existential situation is or anything like this, but to deepen our meditation. Mind becomes peaceful to a certain degree. You know, then if we contemplate this kind of this skillfully, then our meditation will go deeper, more peaceful, cooler, kind of chill-out experience. Nibbida, disenchantment, is a cool experience, cool, still experience, a stopping. And then starting again. Here we still are, aren't we? We still are with the body and the situation that we're in. So we can experience this kind of letting go and stopping, letting go into the space. There we are in the space, still, peaceful. And we've gained a new perspective on our situation, whatever it might be. And this goes from these very radical things, which of course are the things that can really get the message home, or to very mundane things about our lives in the monastery, where we can find ourselves, you know, at times, and it's looking a bit of a thin brown line over here, isn't it? You know, there's a phrase, thin blue line, with the police, you know, against the rioters, and not enough police. It's looking a bit like the thin brown line over here, and quite a lot to do. I don't know how it is over there, looking a bit more, a few more of you over there. But a few of the monks been, you know, expressing how there's so much to do right now. Not many guests at the back. More of you over there. And we're a bit thin on this side. It's a bit strained. And so, seemed a bit ironic. That's because I so often praise Amravati and I say, oh, you know, you practice at Amravati, you can develop this tremendous breadth of practice, you know, it goes going across all conditions, you know, where you keep your sati, you learn your kind of social training, and you learn to keep your sati through all kinds of different situations. It's a really great place to train. And now it seems, rather than being broad, it seems rather stretched. I mean, it's a bit different, isn't it? That can be an unpleasant experience, and unless we can really accept our limitations, or even have these limitations be something that liberates us from a sense of trying to control or to master something that's not masterable, something that we can't master, and find this kind of freedom of heart. And we start taking things much more lightly. However it's going to be, Amravati's not going to be perfect. I mean, it's never been perfect. And you see that there's a little bit of dirt over there. I don't mean that. There's a spider. See, that spider's come in. You know, it's spoilt everything. It's in this beautiful temple. It can never be perfect, isn't it? Because it's been part of nature. And things still, we can't, sealing it off from nature. Well, how about the weather? You know, it's a big factor right now, isn't it? And it's another thing that's completely beyond our control. And that can be something that can be a disturbing influence or disturbing to the mind. Or we can, you know, we can be frightened even these days with global warming, you know, climate change. Everything's going out of our control. Oh my God! You know, it could be the end of the world. It could, couldn't it? It could. Could be coming. So this can be as well a depressing fact or a liberating one, depending how it strikes us, depending how we contemplate that. Because that perception can help us to let go of our attachment to things. Not trying to be trying to control, which doesn't mean that we're not trying to do our best. So my motto in life, my Buddhist motto in life, is to do my best and accept whatever happens. This is my motto. So this is all in the direction of accepting whatever happens, isn't it? Which you get a lot of good teaching on this here. This is another big strength of Amaravati, is that. But this perception of anatta has a lot to say about what doing your best is, actually. When you think that doing your best is getting everything just right, if we can't really see our limitations or come to terms with our limitations, then doing our best can become a kind of idealism, rather than something grounded. And I did, luckily enough, when I was at college years ago, I was studying for my finals, and I went to see a friend of mine who is East London, and his landlady was a very elderly, frail Cockney lady. And I started telling her about how stressed I was about my finals at college coming up. And she just said to me, "You can only do your best, dear." Like this. And something in me just went, it's just the way she said it. It was a whole character. You know, I've been living in East London a few years and come to love the Cockney character. So it was a lot in that sentence, and the way she said it. You can only do your best, dear. And so I had to keep saying that to myself, you know, over and over and over. Can only do your best, dear. You know, so we can. It's the best we can do. That's all we can do, isn't it? Yeah. And be human beings. You know, so we keep a place. Needs to be making an effort to keep a human family feeling, isn't it? Around a monastery, which acknowledges these kinds of limitations, frailties, elderly people to look after. You know, that can be a lovely thing, you know, full of Dhamma. It's a Dhamma right in your face, isn't it? Looking after somebody who's sick or elderly. It would be a beautiful thing to do. Seeing somebody else, how their whole system is got its limitations and out of control and can't, not working, not operating. But it's the same for all of us, isn't it, at times? You know, our system could be not operating. However much we might want to do this or do that, and my system is not operating today. And here we are in a kind of living in the workplace, you know, then, you know, it has to be a sensitivity to this, you know. Can't expect people to just, can't expect this to be a kind of 24/7 job. So there needs to be an effort, I think, to keep creating and recreating this sense of family, extended family, where the bottom, there's this kind of bottom line of looking out for each other and looking out for the essentials. You know, this is my brother, you know, and make sure that my brother's okay, you know. Even if you don't have anything in common with your brother, isn't it? And you still bottom line is that you're still looking after the base, you still want to make sure that your brother's okay. This kind of bottom line sense of commitment to each other. But at the same time, an acknowledgement of our limitations, you know, not. And here we are, and I remember starting off the monastery when I was an abbot in Norway, and we were given a farm and a place, there's nothing in it, it was an empty barn and an empty house, and the group of people that took over the place to look after a farm was a psychologist, me, a philosopher, an ex-boxer and a language expert. So we had no practical skills whatsoever between us. You know, so it's, what we're going to buy first, a saw or a hammer or something, you know, it's like that. I'm not sure. What, you know, a screwdriver. Which end do you hold? You know, as bad as that, you know. But there was a great kind of family feeling about it. You know, we had a lot of laughs over it. And it wasn't a sense of, we can't do this. You know, we really expect ourselves to be knowing what to do. And then luckily, you know, being there in Norway, there's a lot of very practical people. Norwegians are a very grounded, practical race. So the local farmer started telling us how to do things. And we got into a relationship with a local farmer, this exchange relationship where he did things for us and we did things for him. And the whole thing started to come together. And us two being vulnerable, you know. So you know, sometimes I think we shouldn't be called venerables, we should be called vulnerables, isn't it? You know, this is what we are, you know, in many ways. We've been putting ourselves in this vulnerable position, and we're human beings, aren't we? You know, and not just minds, we've got these bodies, remember, you know, wrapped up in the sheet, wrapped up in the brown sheet, there's these bodies, isn't it? With their limitations, which get more and more apparent as you get older, and be something that you could start to laugh about if you got the right. So, you know, tonight, and getting up and the knees cracking, and the, you know, there's so many reminders. I'm only 64. I'm not an old man, but still, you know, you realise it's coming. But there can be a sense of release over that, of all the pride and the vanity and the striving of youth can disappear, and there can be a tremendous sense of relief. Which to me is what the monastic life is about. So, you know, not about becoming a career monastic and, you know, how am I going to get more views on YouTube, you know, make my career something. With my great mind, but actually acknowledging our frailty. It really takes something, doesn't it, to do that, and to do it without it being a negative thing. But actually, this can be the natural result of skillful contemplation practice. And we can see the suffering of hanging on and carrying this thing around. So to me, there's more suffering now when I've got this responsibility now with my heart condition to get. I'm supposed to get my heart rate up to 140 every day. So let's go leaping up and down the hill. So it's been teaching a retreat. I'd go come across the road and go leaping up and down the hill before the next session. There's much more of a burden to that. It's kind of, oh gosh, you know, I've got to go. It's a bit like I've got to go and take the body for a walk, you know, and go and exercise it. And you could see the burden of, you know, I've got to exercise it, I've got to feed it, I've got to keep it warm, I've got to. Here we go. I remember those moments where I just sat there and I just completely let go. But the beauty of this whole thing is that you can be letting go the whole time. You can be letting go into your running routine, or letting go into all these looking after the body. You pick it up in a light way. So it's a light touch on life, isn't it? It's not a controlling touch on life. You're developing a lighter touch, not just letting things be the way they are, you know, but a lighter touch on the world, a playful. Recognizing the limitations. There's a big quality of elderly people, isn't it? They start, you know, smiling at each other about it all, about all this. I was watching a Cockney old people's home where people laughing and joking about the state of their bodies. Have you been today, dear? kind of thing. Yeah, good. Laughing about it. So it's very different from a kind of spiritual idealism, which would have us be a kind of Superman, you know. And some people, you know, they get very strong practice. You know, they can think they don't have any limitations. You know, they never feel tired. You know, they can pile into things, and I never feel, you know, they feel great, Superman, until the body catches up with them. So to always recognize the physical aspect of our lives is something that bonds us together and keeps us down to earth and bonds us together and lightens it all up, you know, in the right spirit. You know, what are we going to do with these bodies? You know, are you going through another whole process of building, you know, putting up another building for the bodies, you know, to keep them warm and, you know, it's this, all this. And you can come back to the body, can't it? And you go, okay, we're going to actually be able to keep bodies warm for many years to come, in these, and warm and dry for many years to come. But it's all part of this same burden that we're carrying, isn't it? Another aspect, you know, hoovering up after the body or whatever, all these things that we do. So if we see it, all this is a burden in a light way, you know, then that can lead us to let go of attachment. And that's actually, the detached state is then a very loving one. It's not an unloving state. This is, say, the wisdom side of the practice. And yet also to see the frailty of people's bodies is a source of compassion, isn't it? You see ageing samanas who are starting to struggle to get around or whatever it is. It's also a source of compassion, not just of wisdom and freedom, but also of love and compassion. Both of those things become just natural morality, natural virtue arising out of acknowledging our physical predicament. And not just becoming minds, you know. So as usual, anyone who knows me, you know, is going to be drifting back to the subject of the body. But, you know, have to forgive me, it's my thing. Yeah. All got our thing. Yeah. But I found it very helpful. And you see how it pays off at these crucial moments. You know? And in the ambulance with a heart rate of 260, nothing I could do. And the paramedic saying, "Do you have a headache? You know, you got any chest pains?" You might as well have been saying, "Are you having a heart attack or a stroke?" And yet, you know, something in me, experiencing or seeing that sense of nothing I can do, was letting go as a whole thing, a whole situation. It's not that I couldn't respond, you know. It's just entering into a different state of mind over the whole thing, not an unresponsive one, just a detached state of mind. So we can have to corner ourselves, you know, in order to get to squeeze something out of us like this, isn't it? And, you know, these kinds of health incidents is one way or one thing that can happen to us. But it can all be all kinds of things that can come along that can corner us into seeing our own limitations. And us to finally realise, okay, so it's calming down into life. And particularly as we get older. I had a need, definite need after my heart incident. To also acknowledge this monastery because, you know, this monastery saved me actually. And it's thanks to this monastery I could keep my doctor's advice and take a lot of rest for the months after the heart incident. So tremendous gratitude to Amravati for helping me out at that time. All I had to do was to run up and down the hills and try and avoid eating the cakes, and I got a lot better. That wasn't easy, actually. Second part, and the biscuits, that wasn't easy. He could have hidden them from me or something, it would have been better. But apart from that, it was the ideal environment. You know, I was over there in the forest on my own and chilling out and taking walks and so on. So I had a tremendous sense of gratitude for that. Now, where was I? I was going somewhere else. I had a good diversion. I don't know where I am now. Anyone remind me where I was? Yeah. So this is a way of keeping ourselves or keeping our feet on the ground, isn't it? You know, so to me, the whole spiritual teaching, you know, is about having your head in heaven and your feet on the ground, or your heart in heaven, say, and your feet on the ground. And that's the combination that gets the wisdom and compassion running naturally out of your mind. Those two together, not just one or the other. And of course, you know, there's times when I've lost it over the years and got carried away and flying high. And, you know, I remember writing a poem about letting go of some kind of letting go of the body and showing it to my mother. And she just said, I think it sounds to me like you're just being flippant about suffering. I said, Whoops. Thank God for Mum, isn't it? It's having somebody like my mum, a lot of you would have met my mother, of course, who could be very straight with me. I was walking along a riverbank with a very old friend of mine I'd known since I was 18. I was at home, we went for a walk together, and I was talking to him, and he stopped me and he just said, all right. Thanks for the Dhamma talk, Ajahn. I realised I was completely stuck in teaching mode. And it took my oldest friend to actually point it out and for me to actually become normal and stop teaching. It was these early days in Norway where I was just full on in teaching mode. It brought me back to the ground. Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. Other times, you know, it's more of a crunch, isn't it, when you end up back on the ground after flying around. But there's such a solidity to the ground, isn't it? When you get there, you let go and you end up on the ground. And you know, what can go wrong, really? You know, you make an idiot of yourself or something. It doesn't really matter. You know, you've got your sense of your own limitations. You've not got this kind of not overblowing yourself somewhere or another. Anyway, so I remember lovely moments of, you know, having very eminent Tyre Jones coming over. I remember a very eminent monk sitting in the sala over there at the mealtime. Lots of people, hundreds of people. He sat there and just started picking his nose in front of everybody in the most natural way, you know, just completely relaxed and unashamed. Something beautiful about that. A great grounded forest tradition. It's a tremendous sort of, I don't know if it's a, to me it's like it looked like a contradiction, but actually it's more like a connection being made between this kind of heavenly realm of the kind of great magical side of the Thai forest tradition, tremendous kind of minds, and this extremely grounded basis, living out in the forest and the hardship of it. And the elderly monks kind of groaning as they're getting up. It's a kind of special Krubrajan kind of. So it's not, I don't see it as a negative thing that, you know, so, you know, we have, thankfully, monks surviving into their old age in our monasteries. I see it as a tremendously positive thing. Bless them. That can be such a source of wisdom and compassion and of maturing of our community from an idealistic, and if we can do anything, Superman kind of thing, in my eyes, to a more mature, grounded, steady thing. Still not lacking the magic, not losing that. It's like bringing heaven down to earth. Plonk. Right here amongst us, plonk into the earth. That's the way I experience a Thai forest tradition. Got weight and gravitas. Now, the gravitas is that acknowledgement of the physical, and also not into denial of it, floating off into the mind. Ooh. Not like that. So it's a bit unfortunate that Western Buddhism arrived at the same time as the drugs and the hippie generation and all the psychedelics, and got confused with the drug experiences and the meditation experiences all got mixed up, and people think it's like, you can get high on meditation, high on drugs, and you get these wonderful experiences. And like a friend of my mother's, who she told one of her neighbours I'd become a monk, and she said, "Oh, it's better than drugs, dear." And she's actually kind of half equating the two as she said that. It's sort of similar, but it's better than the drugs. So it's a shame that it has that. It's come over with that. It lost its ground. And became a bit, ooh. It's a shame. Because the sense, the greatest potential of the practice is actually within this recognition, within this grounding effect, like a depth charge. And you see, last time I saw, I was very privileged to have met Longdo Mahabura a number of times. And the last time I met him, he was at a fundraising ceremony for a hospital wing for monks in Thailand. And he travelled several hours across Thailand to this ceremony. And He got out of the bus and it was clear he wasn't well from the start. You know, he's coughing a lot and looking very unsteady on his feet. So, you know, being at a hospital and lots of medics and everyone is gathered around him and were checking him out, and you know, it seemed okay, but he was not in good health. And he insisted on going ahead and giving a Dhamma talk. So they took him to the high seat, and he sat on the high seat and had his attendant next to him. And he started giving a talk, and he started coughing, and then he just wavered a bit and fell asleep. And he woke up, and woke up a few minutes later, about 2 or 3 minutes later, and turned to his attendant and said, "Well, how long have I been talking like that?" And then he says, "Oh, 20 minutes, long time." And he started again, and just where he left off and where he thought he might have left off, something like this. So he seemed totally at ease with the situation, being there in public and there with all his limitations. He's 93 or something like this at this point. Falling asleep, waking up, not really getting it together, and completely at ease with the situation. Something very beautiful about that. And also about the fact that the Thai people who came along, and that they would normally bow to Long Da at the beginning of a talk. When he started talking, they just stayed down with their hands in Anjali, bowed with their foreheads on the floor for the entire talk. It's very moving to see this kind of spontaneous showing of respect to somebody who was being so selfless, so steady, so strong, something like this. All these qualities. A beautiful thing. So I hope I could come to you from the Dhamma seat one day, and many years' time, toothless and frail and coughing. never giving up, you know, this kind of spirit, great Thai forest tradition spirit. I'm just trying to think how I can summarise what I've said. It went up and around a bit, didn't it? But so I think my main encouragement here is to be accepting of limitation, but also to see that. The reflections that you develop through seeing and accepting your limitations as potentially liberating. That's potential. So you're cooling down and cooling down and cooling down, and then the mind becomes more peaceful, and then there can be a letting go, stopping and letting go, and starting afresh on a whole new perspective. So, yeah, I'd like to, wish that for this man with the heart problem. But it's so difficult, isn't it, that if you're in trouble and you haven't prepared yourself, then it's a very difficult situation to be in. If you're in that kind of situation and you've prepared yourself, then it's a whole different thing. You need to turn it around completely. So many years ago, there's a monk called, who disrobed, and Paul Breiter, I think, who disrobed and decided he was going to take up hospice work in order to spread the Dhamma to people who were dying. And he asked Lumpur Cha what he thought of his idea. And Lumpur Cha said, as I would probably say with my hospital experience as well, he said, what difference do you think it would make to hand someone a lotus flower if you've got a red hot poker sticking in your side? Then what difference is it going to make to be handed a lotus flower? Perhaps that's what it could amount to, you know, if it's too late. Like a perfunctory thing, a blessing. Whereas if you're prepared for that red hot poker, then it's a different thing altogether. This is what we're ultimately preparing ourselves for, isn't it? But in a way that's in a way that we die before we die, say. So we've got nothing left to lose, isn't it? We could die before we die. Nothing left to lose. So I offer that few reflection this evening.